and the modern foundations of body and soul. And he talks about the history of how we got to the way we think about ourselves today compared to the pre-Enlightenment era. So what I'd like to do is talk about folk metaphysics in the pre and then during and post-Enlightenment era. And so I have this little flow chart here. And so if we think about the medieval era, 1000 or 1600 AD, we have, I want to understand and remember this relationship between how the law thinks about deviant behavior and how psychiatry and medicine think about deviant behavior, right? So in the medieval era, the view of madness, which is the old term for what we today call mental illness, so mad people were either possessed by demons or were suffering punishment from God, again, in the Western European traditions. The social control for mad persons was from the church and the community, and so they would, disruptive bad people would be put in the stocks, and undisruptive mad people would be quietly tolerated and allowed to sleep in the barn as long as they didn't disturb the horses and so forth. The view of criminal wrongdoing in the medieval era was, as you might imagine, sin, while social control of criminal wrongdoing back then was the church and the community. So in some ways, it's even a misnomer to talk about crime in the medieval era, because it really, as crime as we understand it today, didn't really exist. Sin existed, and sin was expected to be that everyone struggled with sin, we're all sinners, and that there was nothing distinctively different about sins we today call crime, and sins that today we simply see as ordinary immorality. During the Enlightenment era, these things, these attitudes and social mechanisms started to change. This is, again, late 1600s and 1700s. The view of madness during this period shifted to that of sickness or disease and the disturbance of nature. The social control mechanism shifted from the church and community to medicine. This was, again, way before psychiatry was invented. The methods were science, treatment, and prevention, and the view of criminal wrongdoing during the Enlightenment was still sin and a failure of morality. The social control was still the church, and the methods were worship, education, and threat as they are today. Then, in the post-Enlightenment period, again, I'm making these stages look very concrete, but we're talking about hundreds, decades, if not 100 years or more of transition it was very irregular. There's what I call the Enlightenment split. And so this is because of these changes in attitudes of the intellectual elites of the Enlightenment era. The ordinary peasant, again, the guy on the dirt road, so to speak, really continued to have very similar ideas about all of these things from the medieval era. But people like John Locke and Hume and Kant, Francis Bacon, one of the founders of modern science, these people started to reformulate these views of madness and change them from rather than being demon possession or punishment to disturbances of nature. This cashed out in two ways. The first, medicine and psychiatry inherited madness, and madness was explained by scientific causality and treated by disease. So science and medicine got madness, while criminal and common law, at least in the English common law and criminal law, inherited wrongful conduct and was explained by failure of faith or failure to resist temptation, and was treated as a moral failing with punishment. So we have here madness treated as disease, and here is wrongdoing treated with punishment. And then, of course, now we have this mixed up hodgepodge today, which I'm going to then spend the rest of the lecture talking more about. the Enlightenment split tended, as I mentioned, to prevail among educated people, but in the ordinary, the peasant, the lay person, tended to persist in the more traditional views of madness immorality that were church-driven. Of course, we all recognize there's lots of diversity in these beliefs today, and we generally tolerate our folk metaphysical contradictions very well. And so I'm going to give you some examples of how this contradiction between madness as sin or demon possession and madness as medicine gets confounded in our post-Enlightenment era. So the American Psychiatric Association, I could show you a document that explicitly says pedophilia is both a disorder and a criminal behavior. Okay. So remember what I said about folk metaphysical beliefs, that we rarely are troubled by them. We simply accept the contradictions. So if pedophilia is a disorder, and it's a disease, and it has multiple scientific causality, then it's hard to think about these people having simple free will, like the person who decides to rob a bank, on the one hand. And on the other hand, thinking of them as criminals and having free will and individual responsibility. We have lots of in the news about disputes about creationism and evolutionism, but these things are only troubling to relatively few people. Again, I doubt most of us who are among the most interested in these sorts of debates probably spend much of our time wringing our hands about this. We leave this to be disputed in other domains. As another example of these contradictions, folk metaphysical contradictions, neuroscientists seem unconcerned about the mind-brain problem. That is, the idea that how is it that this material stuff generates things like ideas? As I tease them, I say either that you don't worry about it or you declare it solved by yourselves. And then I gave you some examples of folk metaphysical assumptions. So we sort of entertain the idea that the devil made me do it on the one hand, but I was, you know, under stress at the same time, and, you know, the stress made me do it. So the Enlightenment split was important not just because of this, but and it was not simply a division of intellectual labor and cultural trend. That is, madness goes to medicine and crime and immorality goes to the church and law. It really depicted an emerging facet of modern class distinctions. I have Locke here as an example. On the one hand, the Enlightenment ideas were driven by intellectual elite of academics, aristocrats, and the educated wealthy. On the other hand, ordinary people maintain their metaphysical assumptions through their Abrahamic monotheistic religions, namely Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Also split off, the Enlightenment split off morality from proto-psychology. So this is really interesting for people in the psychological sciences. So morality was mostly the domain of religion and law, as we saw by how criminal law and the church handled immorality. And psychology became the domain of the science, as it was medicine and later psychiatry. So what's interesting about this is only in the past 20 years or so that scientific psychology and neuroscience has taken very serious interest in the biological and psychological aspects of morality. Before that time, there was very little scientific literature in psychology and neuroscience about morality. All morality was, again, left to the church and left to the law. Excuse me. And finally, you're probably starting to understand that this was the beginnings of the fragmentation of culture, as I call it. We talk about the science wars, the culture wars, arguments about religion versus science, and so forth. Again, with these consequent contradictions of folk metaphysics. Okay, so you're with me so far. So now I'm going to talk about mental health and how folk metaphysical contradictions drive some problems we have in mental health. So the first topic is crime and mental illness. So in psychiatry, we have a lot of ambivalence about people's responsibility, personal responsibility for actions. So this is a metaphysical assumption of the medieval church up into the present. That is that I'm an individual, I'm responsible for my conduct, I'm responsible for my salvation, I am accountable for my behaviors, and I get what I deserve. That is, I get dessert. That's my just desserts. That's how criminal law works, right? So psychiatrists sort of believe that on the one hand, but they also think that we think sometimes people misbehave because of these complex causal explanatory sciences that we have these abundant scientific research and theory and proof around. So we have major mental disorders like, for example, schizophrenia or bipolar disorder that we think primarily of as diseases, but then we have these conditions called personality disorders that oftentimes our colleagues think of, my own psychiatric colleagues think of as moral and intentional. So we may be forgiving people who do wrongful things while they're psychotic with schizophrenia, but we don't forgive them when they have a personality disorder. So we hold them responsible. And so that's confusing for us and for our patients, actually. So perhaps this really boils down most strongly with the so-called insanity defense. And so you probably know this. So someone who commits a crime, usually a violent crime, is examined. The defense will invoke the insanity defense, saying that this person was crazy at the time of their actions and therefore they can't be responsible and that they should be found not guilty by reason of their insanity. So the insanity defense is a controversial clash between the metaphysics of complex causality from the science side of the Enlightenment split and the individual responsibility and desert demanding punishment from the law church side of the metaphysical, folk metaphysics. Another example is we have these weird, I mentioned already, DSM categories that bridge the world of crime and mental illness. I mentioned pedophilia. We have this condition called intermittent explosive disorder where people, you probably know it best as road rage, where you're driving along LBJ and you cut somebody off and they pull a pistol out and start shooting. Now, a person with intermittent explosive disorder, that's not a one-time thing. It's something that happens frequently, multiple times a week or even daily. Not shooting necessarily, but having explosive violent temper. We have this condition called conduct disorder, which is basically defined as children who can't conform to societal laws and misbehave systematically, and I mentioned antisocial personality disorder. So in the United States and in the United Kingdom law, we have what criminal justice and legal theorists call retributive justice. That is justice as retribution. So again, this is related to the folk metaphysical assumption about people are responsible for their individual conduct and they get their just deserts. That is, they get punished for the wrongdoing that they do. And of course, in criminal justice, in criminology and law, there's this very difficult dispute about whether criminal law should punish people or whether we should try to reform or rehabilitate them. And indeed, there are alternative forms of criminal justice, so-called restorative justice, where the offender and offended come together and try to strike some sort of agreed-upon compensation for the offense. And this has been experimented with in various jurisdictions here in the U.S., but particularly in places like Australia. And indeed, in many ways, restorative justice is very similar to the kind of justice you see in Native American cultures, where if a member of a Native American tribe has wronged someone, it's not like they're put in prison and punished. Rather, the offender is then expected to provide some sort of service, or pay money, or pay some sort of restoration to the offended. So this idea of retributive justice and punishment and just deserts is based on this medieval metaphysics of individualistic responsibility, free will, and deserve. You get what you deserve. Lex talionis, an eye for an eye. This contrasts this with psychiatric complex causal understandings of misconduct and illness. So I've already talked to you. So are someone that does something wrongful in psychiatry, they're just as likely to be seen as operating from a disease and certain social, psychological, historical circumstances that in part control their behavior in a very graded fashion rather than the either-or of the criminal justice system. So these confusions in the folk metaphysical assumptions of law on the one hand and psychiatry on the other really have devastating social consequences. The United States, believe it or not, you may or may not know, the United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. Higher incarceration by far than Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan. Name the trouble spot, your favorite trouble spot. We have more people in prison than they do.
They just behead them over there, right? We'll bypass the jails.
I'm not even sure if I could go that far, but the average crime control for Western industrialized nations we only have average crime. By the way, worldwide, and especially in the industrialized nations, crime continues to trickle down and become less common, especially violent crime. We don't know why. The criminologists don't know why. It's just happening. It seems to have nothing to do with crime policy, because it persists regardless of what the laws are, what the law changes, or whether we're tough on crime or not.
In the developed, industrialized world.
In the industrialized world, yeah. In fact, it is the downward trend in crime in the Western world is the major problem in criminology. Nobody knows the answer to why this is, and that's why we have all politicians arguing with this and that, because nobody really knows what reduces crime. Another aspect is public attitudes about mental illness. This guy here is Anthony Jorm, who is an Australian social scientist, and he's probably the world's foremost authority on mental health literacy. Mental health, you probably heard about health literacy. That is, what does the average person know about health that's important for maintaining your own health? How educated are people about health? Well, mental health literacy is how educated are people about mental health. And so this would be things like, what are the symptoms, if you had symptoms of mental illness in yourself, would you recognize them? If you had symptoms of mental illness, what would you do? What can you do to diminish your chances of developing a mental illness, et cetera, right? So his research that involves multiple countries, including both first world and third world countries, most people around the world don't recognize symptoms of mental illness in themselves or others. This finding is based on a World Health Organization study that was involved multiple countries, and they found that most people waited a year, and many people waited up to 5 years before they sought any kind of treatment for a significant mental health problem. Amazing. Most people recognizing symptoms delay help seeking not by days, weeks, or months, but by years. Most people seek help from family, friends, pastor, and maybe family doctor, with psychiatrists falling last in line behind psychologists, social workers, and lay counselors. So, there you have it. We've got a big job to do. The majority of the public is distrustful of psychiatric medication. JORM reviews a limited number of studies, but findings hold across all these studies. So the question here is that may have to do with folk metaphysics is I think the psychiatry clashes with folk metaphysical beliefs about how one takes care of oneself and how one handles mental distress. A fourth example has to do with mentally ill and non-mentally ill offenders, that is, people who commit crimes. So our nation's jails, prisons, and probation programs carry increasing proportions of mentally ill offenders. Here's from the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is an amazing compilation of crime and imprisonment data that the Department of Justice maintains. So in 2006, 705,600 people nationwide that had major mental illness, 78,000 in federal prisons, and then almost 500,000 in local jails. For those of you who don't know, this is Lou Sterrett Justice Center. This is the largest mental health facility in Dallas County. It has more mentally ill people, and I mean seriously mentally ill people, than any other facility. This above is representative of, again, redundant services, that is, people get multiple social services for the same person and inadequate services. So that the idea of putting people on probation that are mentally ill is a good example of both redundant and inadequate services, because someone's on probation that's mentally ill is going to have great difficulty complying with the terms of their probation on the one hand, and is probably going to have difficulty getting adequate mental health care on the other, as just a for instance. And again, it has to do with the background is the folk metaphysical beliefs that these people get what they deserve versus these people are sick and we need to help them. And so in my field, in philosophy and psychiatry, we have all kinds of related concepts. So I've already mentioned my example from our Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM. This is the official classification of the kinds of mental illness that psychiatrists treat. So I mentioned several examples, and there's more, but not many more. Generally speaking, vice, there's not much vice in the DSM. But do these have any place at all in a category of mental illness? Or is this, again, a manifestation of these confusions about folk metaphysical beliefs? I'm not going to get into, this is a technical discussion in philosophy of mind about compatibilism and incompatibilism. But the question is we have free will. We think we have free will, right? And so is it possible that scientific determinism and free will get along with each other, or are they contradictory? That's the incompatibilism and incompatibilism. So the people will say that free will is incompatible with determinism, and then other people say it's not. And so these claims, these debates are often about common sense and intuitions, and so that's a sign that folk metaphysical assumptions are at work. And again, the whole debate about free will, to say that we're going to talk about free will is already to sort of give up the ship to the medieval folk metaphysical standpoint. So perhaps a free will question without free will would be this. It would not assume free will nor reject it. We could say, how is it that sometimes I feel like my actions are freely chosen, and then other times I feel like I'm compelled by external forces? So that's the question that's the scientific question, and perhaps even the philosophical question. It doesn't necessarily privilege, as we would say in philosophy, the idea of free will as being something, the center of which has to be explained, but rather we should go into the phenomena, which is how is it that we seem to control ourselves sometimes and other times we don't. Medicalization is taking human problems and treating them like medical problems. Should psychiatric medicine be in the business of rehabilitating criminal offenders? So in anthropology, they talk about, in philosophy, we talk about medicalizing crime. So is crime a disease? Is criminal behavior a disease that should be treated? Barry, you're right there in the middle of the full metaphysical belief issue. So very interestingly, U.S. child psychiatry, the development of child psychiatry actually grew out of concern about juvenile delinquency in the middle of the 20th century. And the first child psychiatrists were employed by the courts to help offending youth stay out of trouble. And that was the birth of child psychiatry. It went along in concert with the idea of juvenile courts. It was pretty awful, as you might imagine, up to the early 20th century. Children, when they offended, were thrown in with adults in jail. You can imagine the ramifications. And so the whole juvenile justice movement and the idea of moving juveniles into a separate court system, not only for the courts, but also developing so-called reform schools back then and an educational approach to child offenders rather than treating them as what today we would call competent adults. So thanks for your attention. You all have been very patient. So my conclusions, a consequence of the Western European Enlightenment was a metaphysical division of domains of human problems. Criminality and immorality going to religion and common criminal law, while illness, mental and physical, were taken up by medicine and psychiatry. The full metaphysical division of domains is intellectually non-viable, according to Sadler, and leads to confusion and conceptual flip-flopping in popular culture, medicine, law, philosophy, and public policy. The state of affairs in this is awful and underlies lots of our important social problems that I mentioned. And we need to work on this stuff. And so I have here, for those of you who are interested, some resources in philosophy of psychiatry, just as an aside. We have an association here in the U.S., the Association of Advancement of Philosophy and Psychiatry. If you'd like to see more about these ideas, Ali Mong and I helped develop this site called Sagacity with a P to bring in the psych part. It's a video archives of philosophers of psychiatry, and so you can view video interviews with various philosophers and psychiatrists to talk about these and other issues. We have a journal published by the Johns Hopkins Press. We have a book series in Oxford. And then there's an international consortium of people who have interest in this area, and we meet about once a year in various exotic places around the world. I'm lucky to be going to Santiago, Chile for our international network meeting this October. So there. So at this point, I welcome your discussion and thank you for your attention. We're going to have a Q&A, and I'm going to take this around here. As moderator, I'm going to take the first prerogative of first question. As neuroscience gets more and more sophisticated and we learn, you know, the balances and imbalances of serotonin and dopamine and et cetera, you know, when is it going to be the crime or the whatever was due to Jack or his disease? And how is this going to impact jurisprudence? You know, is the court still going to decide, well, does he know right or wrong? Or is it going to, okay, we're just going to do something with his medications? And is this, so is medicine going to be the reformative or treatment, you know, yeah, versus incarceration?
So the question was, if I'm understanding you right, is what's going to happen is as we become, as science, neuroscience and others become more powerful in explaining human behavior.
Right.
Okay. Ms. Mike.
Yeah, well, you should be okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, I'm going up there.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, so Stephen Morse is the guy I mentioned with the bushy mustache that has talked about
the full metaphysical assumptions of the law about the law depends on people having beliefs and intentions and individual responsibility, and that's how we assign innocence or guilt, right? Well, according to Morse, and I tend to agree with him, there's actually nothing in neuroscientific or scientific advancement that throws that out. So, for example, it still boils down to whether the jury thinks this person was in charge of their behavior or not, and the transaction of that is regarding the testimony of based on intentions and beliefs that the defendant makes. And so if the defendant has a brain tumor, there may be expert testimony that attests to this or that account of the behavior, but it's up to the jury, and the jury is going to assess the guilt or innocence, not necessarily based on what some scientist or psychiatrist says, but on what their judgment of what the person's beliefs and intentions were. And if the jury thinks that, from the evidence presented in the case, apart from the brain tumor, that this person knew what they were doing, then they're probably going to convict. And if they believe this person was completely out of it, had no clue what he or she was doing, then they're probably going to acquit. Yes?
Could you discuss a little bit folk metaphysics as it relates to, or maybe I had it reversed, developmental psychology, conscious level that is conscious among individuals, that type of thing. Is there, I hear some connection there, but I'm not clear on how that would interact.
Well, I have to say that this is not something I've thought a whole lot about. So, but the example that springs to mind was when I gave you examples of folk metaphysical beliefs, of assumptions. And one of them was from some Christian groups think that if the child doesn't have a religious upbringing, then morality doesn't develop. That's been demonstrated repeatedly by developmental psychology to be completely false. The way children learn morality is by what they're taught by their parents, religious or otherwise. So that's an example of that relationship and how it could play out. Yeah.
Do you believe that psychiatry there can be curative?
Wait. I have the power.
Somebody's got the power.
I had thought of this question early, and since then you've covered so much. Now it seems frivolous, but remember the show All in the Family? Archie Bunker.
We're both at a certain age, aren't we?
Yes, all right. Well, Meathead was this like 60s free your mind. It was basically generational chauvinism.
Yeah.
And then Archie was like blue collar xenophobia.
Yeah.
But at least it was time tested. Would you say that, were they engaging in serious folk metaphysics?
So what we might ask are what Archie's folk metaphysical assumptions are. And we might then ask about what Meathead's folk metaphysical assumptions are. We're way out into speculation here since they're fictional characters and one of the actors is dead and the other one's a film director. We could make up a nice story about how Archie is more in the individual responsibility vein and Meathead is, you know, some sort of liberal that, you know, believes in complex causality. But again, that would just be our just-so story.
Well, I would ask the writers if they're still alive.
Okay. And my question was, do you believe that psychiatry can be curative and can a mentally ill person be any more compliant with psychiatry treatment than they could with, say, probation, per se? You know, they have to take your medication, they have to show up for appointments. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know, which is more costly to society?
That's a really good question. That's a really, really complicated. I'm going to
answer it in a roundabout way. And again, this, we're getting deep into political territory. I was just in the Netherlands. The Netherlands has a 60% tax rate, income tax rate. Okay?
60.
6-0. They get cradle to grave health care for everything, including mental illness, including substance abuse, addiction. Okay? Nothing out of pocket. That's the way it works. They have a much lower involuntary treatment rate than the United States, where you know, the rest, about we have lots of uninsured people, people with mental illness have even are worse off, even when they have insurance and so forth and so on, that's another lecture. And so this suggests that there's this inverse relationship. The more complete your cradle-to-grave healthcare is, the less need there is to lock people up.
They're happier.
Just stay out of trouble.
Yeah, they feel less stressed.
And so if you have crummy mental health services that people can't get access to, then their diseases go hog wild, and they get into trouble, and they either end up in the Lucera justice system, if they're lucky, or they end up dead, or if they're even luckier, they might get into some sort of treatment program. Now, you know what your own tax rate is, and so what's the right thing to do? That's for Democrats, democratic societies to figure out. Does that answer your question good enough?
Yeah, I see your point, but,
you
know, that's a tough one.
Yeah, that's really complicated.
John?
Yes.
Yes, sir. You just started to touch on something that I would like to have you comment on further. Our fields of psychiatry, psychology, is often focused on individuals.
Yeah.
The person.
Yeah.
But we have some very pathological environments, society.
Yeah.
But we don't know how to deal with that in our legal system, particularly. Legislation is hard to get through. How can we develop healthier societies or environments?
Yeah.
Rather than just focus only on the individual.
It's like an amazingly broad question. As if I have some sort of, you know, cure-all, which I, of course, don't. What can I say? First of all, you know, I mean, you're sort of suggesting, so what's the practical cash-out for the stuff about folk metaphysical beliefs? Okay, so we have these really discrepant assumptions about the nature of reality and freedom and so forth, right? What do we do with that? Well, it's not like we're going to change the way the courts work overnight or even anytime soon, and it's not very likely we're going to change the way psychiatrists and physicians and scientists think overnight. So is there a more humane way that we can handle criminal offenders that is actually more effective? One of the other interesting findings in criminology is that punishment is pretty ineffective as a deterrent for crime. And so our entire criminal justice system, or most all of it, the vast majority is based on punishment, and it's ineffective. Is it politically feasible to reform the criminal justice system away from a more restorative model? Well, that's really iffy, because the best way to tank a political candidate of either on the right, middle, or left is to say they're soft on crime. And if you believe that person's soft on crime, you're done.
That's right.
That's all you have to do.
Now, I'd suggest maybe social policy of dealing with, say, an issue like jail diversion.
Mm-hmm.
This, in fact, this state is leading a little bit in this whole national factor, diverting juveniles and mentally ill and homeless and veterans
yeah.
from throwing them in jail.
So I think that offers some hope.
Yeah.
But for my, this idea of diversion, instead of putting people in jail that are mentally ill and that make criminal offenses, can we put them into programs? So that's good. The problem is, Texas, for example, is 50th of 50 states in state funding for mental health care. We used to be only 49, but now we're tops.
So now we're behind Mississippi, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah. It seems to me that it's the folk metaphysics of free will that says that we can't, as individuals in a society, take responsibility for those individuals who can't live in the society, and that's why our society remains toxic. But my question was more like, what kind of, besides free will, that a family which has the same genetics and the same environment, one individual sees the struggle against the schizophrenia and resists, and the other member just goes full hog into it, and...
So we have a big epistemological problem right away. How do we know that someone's giving in versus or overwhelmed? I don't know about you, but I've been working on this for 30 years as a clinician, and I still don't know the answer. I don't know when people just give in versus when they give up.
But I also wanted to address the attitude of the rest of the family towards those two people.
Yeah, yeah. Again, these sort of folk, so that's what happens, you know, with families. And so there'll be some families or family members that say, this poor person's sick and we need to try to help him. We need to extend a helping hand, just like you would hold your dying father's hand to his last breath. And then there are other ones who says, this person's an asshole and hell with him. And everyone in between. That's where, and now we're talking in the realm of family therapy that psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers do to try to clarify those
attitudes. My question attitudes. Is, of course, the one who struggles against it,
yeah.
whether or not they get credit. Or
the,
because
the patient, the ill person struggles against?
There's two, the one who struggles and the one who gives in, and the one who struggles is not given any credit for achieving that struggle. It's like they had no problem at all. To the family.
Yeah. I'm not sure how to answer your question.
We're going to have two more quick questions, okay?
Okay.
We got to get out of here.
All right. Time's up.
I'm going to follow up a little bit on something you said a few minutes ago. Psychiatric treatment and psychological therapy have to undergo, I assume, quite a bit of rigorous study about their effectiveness and safety. So
sure.
We don't just treat people the way we kind of feel like they ought to. If we assume, or if we accept that a lot of criminal behavior is a result of mental illness, and if, as a culture, we decided the best way to treat criminal behavior is by locking people up with people just like them for a limited period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody studied the effectiveness and safety of that treatment?
So if you're at the question, I'm going to reformulate the question in a form that I can answer. So the question is, do we know if involuntary treatment, locking people up and treating them against their will, is effective compared to not doing that? The answer is we don't know. But it's also, there's almost no scientific evidence that involuntary treatment is effective, that it saves lives. Now, you can probably ask a bunch of different psychiatrists, they'll have different opinions, and it'll probably vary from patient to patient. Well, it depends on what patient you're talking about. So that's one issue. The other issue is, this is not, involuntary treatment's not the psychiatrist's fault. We think it is. But as my resident colleagues and graduates that are here can attest, you know, there's a certain societal expectation. If someone is dangerous and they're under my nose, I have a certain legal sense of obligation to not just protect the patient, but to protect others. And so they're, you know, we're worried about malpractice suits and so forth, so we turn somebody loose to kill somebody or injure somebody. And so it's not like we freely choose that. I know one of the things I look for in residents is when they involuntarily treat someone that they feel bad about it, because they should, because it's a horrible thing. But it may be the alternative is worse. That's the problem. We don't know. Yes, sir.
I have what I think is a factual question.
Okay.
You talked about some of the categories used in DSM.
Yeah.
Being basically criminal conduct.
Yeah, immoral criminal conduct.
We have a fairly recent edition of DSM out now.
DSM-5.
Is it different now from what it was earlier?
No.
Are there fewer cases like that in
no.
DSM?
In fact, there may even be more. But that's another story.
Thank you very, very much. Canal that broke the chain. Mr. Canal.